Look, I know a lot of people give Americans a bum rap for being stupid.
Americans can do anything.
The President and I have shared a number of very special experiences, very special experiences, very special experiences.
The United States.
Of the United States.
The alliance between the United States of America and Australia is deeply embedded in the minds of millions of Australians.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Belinda Lopez, and today we're telling stories about the United States of America and pitting the idea of America against its realities. Americans usually have a global monopoly on telling stories about themselves, but not today. We're telling very Aussie stories about politics and protesters, Oprah and openness, and finding out what stories about America tell us about ourselves. But first, we're going to tell you a little story about American pop songstress Lana Del Rey. And why would you do that, you ask? Bryony Doyle's about to tell you why. There's a language warning on this one.
Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Lana Del Rey's 2012 video for National Anthem opens with the singer shot in black and white faux Super 8, posing as Marilyn Monroe, singing happy birthday, playing with her hair, mounting a smile. In the front row, US President ASAP Rocky in the ill-fitting suit and baseball cap looks up, stone cool from the shadows. The film cuts, and suddenly we're in full colour, at the scene of President JFK's 1964 assassination. The sound of crowd chaos on a historically significant Dallas street rises up over a slow hip-hop beat. Another cut in a flutter of many, and now Del Rey is Jackie Kennedy in trademark style, flitting around the gardens of a Cape Cod mansion, tending the flower beds, mothering little black Kennedy children. She and ASAP pose in tableaus from Kennedy family home movies, reappropriating with gangster's license. Del Rey butters toast while awkwardly smoking a cigarette. Rocky toasts democracy with his homies and a glass of yak. The couple relieve stress, perhaps about the Cuban Missile Crisis, by bumping ass to groin on the USS Sequoia. Then we are back on the streets of Dallas, riding in the midnight blue Lincoln limo with the suicide doors. ASAP places a presidential hand on First Lady thigh. The camera makes a fuss of Jackie Del Rey's manicure. It's another beautiful day for the rich and powerful, but we all know what happens next. We've seen it before. Anticipating her loss, Del Rey waxes nostalgic over minor strings.
And I loved him. I loved him. I loved him.
The gunshot reintroduces the percussion. Jackie Del Rey's eyes widen. She looks back to the Secret Service agent before attempting to crawl out across the boot of the Lincoln. Then we get the whole clip again in little cuts. Lana's life as Jackie as offered up in 6 minutes, flashing before our eyes. It's crass, tasteless, intriguing, kitsch, and I've become completely obsessed with it. After every gunshot, I replay the loop.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
Del Rey is famous for her visual style. All her clips are presented as video collage, a hobby she claims to have been cultivating since a tender age. National Anthem is not the first time she's mixed fantasy and reality. In her breakout single, Video Games, she used paparazzi video of drunk starlet Paz de la Huerta, a smear of authenticity on the fucked-up glamour girl posture of her song. Patriotism, too, is a Del Rey aesthetic marker. She uses it in the Tommy Hilfiger sense. An earlier single, Born to Die, begins and ends with Del Rey naked, gripped in the tattooed yet paternal arms of a shirtless hunk as the stars and stripes billow behind them. Del Rey's America is a place that only exists in images and stories. She's a Disneyland patriot, waving the flag of a country that no longer really exists.
Yeah.
In National Anthem, Del Rey takes the logical next step, eroticizing American history with pornographic panache. By reenacting these images, Del Rey does a drag show America. Drag shows have a canny way of revealing the constructed nature of the original object. The over-exaggerated pantomime femininity of nightclub drag queens reveals gender as a gestural theatre, a way of applying lipstick, of cocking the hips. Like most pop stars, Del Rey is a master drag artist, whether she knows it or not. Her object is a nostalgic woman ideal torn from old movies and magazines. Monroe, Nancy Sinatra, 60s girl groups, and every now and then some strange, offensively white caricature of native/Latin/African-American culture. It's easy to make the case that Del Rey's dragging a drag, lip-syncing something that was an act from the get-go. The Kennedy assassination, then, is a perfect historical narrative for her to play dress-up with. After all, it was Jackie Kennedy who first coined the analogy of her time with JFK in the White House as Camelot, you know, the fictional kingdom of egalitarianism, chivalry, magic, swords and witches. The Kennedy presidency was the first to exist largely through the proliferation of media images beamed into the home via TV sets. A president was no longer a disembodied voice on the wireless, some picture in the paper or a distant figure in a parade. JFK is in our lounge room, even when he's dead. There is certainly the sense when you trawl the YouTube Kennedy archive, home movies, old news clips, to-camera addresses, speeches, Jackie's famous tour of the White House, the Zapruder assassination tape, that you are handling the raw seed that germinated our present-day miasma of TV politics. With the Kennedy media material, we see the full power of the TV image before the master manipulators learned all the tricks of how to wield it, before the cutting and pasting of moving images was something a bored teenager could do as a hobby. Who has the right to recreate history? When does reenactment make a claim to truth, and when is it drag? Is there a difference? Of course, Del Rey has no truck with coherence. Her take on Kennedy is the logical climax of a cultural obsession. There is no conspiracy, no aching for authenticity, no desire for connection with the real. Video nostalgia means you are, always and never, home.
He was charismatic.
Her patriotism is real, but it's patriotism for both the mythology and the dirty truths it conceals. Segueing effortlessly from Del Rey back into the archive, I watch another loop of the Zapruder tape. The midnight blue Lincoln moves swiftly into shot, flags hanging flaccidly from the fenders. There are a few sparse groups of observers by the road, but most, like Adam Zapruder, the man who shot the film, are presumably further back. Jackie is wearing a pink pillbox hat. Her husband moves towards her, maybe a hand on the thigh, but there's no zoom, no fussy manicure, no batting lashes. When the film was initially released, there was a conspiracy over some missing frames. But looking back, it's like we need the space created by the missing frame to insert something more. The grain on the film, the shadow on the manicured lawn, the sign for the turnpike. It's as banal as anything. The gunshot is a flash of smoke, a crisis, a historical marker after which everything is re-narrated. Even though it's obvious what's going on in this clip, it's still a moment on which we can hang a crisis of representation. Mostly though, when I watch the Zapruder tape after hours of pop songs, postmodern polemic, telemovies and blockbuster narrative, I'm struck by how quiet it is. What differentiates these images from all the copies and spin-offs and critiques is perhaps also the defining characteristic of any moment constructed as innocent. It fails to speak for itself. Compared with the cacophony of culture, history is so fucking silent. I guess for us, the YouTube archivists and archaeologists, history's become a drag.
I begged him to stay. Try to remember what we had at the beginning.
Bryony Doyle, and that was taken from her essay Dragging Out History, featured in the latest edition of The Lifted Brow. It's all about music. And you can head to our website, allthebestradio.com, to find out how to pick up a copy. That piece was produced by Jess O'Callaghan. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Belinda Lopez. We're talking about the US of A today, and our producer Madeline Cummings brings you a story straight from there.
America has always been a very comfortable idea to me. I guess you could say I wanted to be American because I almost was one. My parents moved to Australia in the early 90s, just before I was born. My mum was American and my dad is Scottish, and they came close to settling in the States. They decided on Australia mostly because my dad was offered citizenship. But there were other more important reasons. Healthcare was a big one. My mum had cystic fibrosis, and they both knew that living in Australia would be better for her, as they'd be able to afford the medication she needed. But still, America remained something of a nostalgic childhood dream. I visited many times growing up, every year or so at least. I spent summers there. I swam in my grandparents' neighbour's pool, shucked corn on the deck before 4th of July parties, and caught fireflies between my fingers late into the evenings. I considered myself Australian first, American second, and tried many times to return home with an American accent, rolling the R's off my tongue over and over again. In August of 2012, when I was 21 years old, I decided to live out my own American dream, to live in the country as an adult, and travel to Asheville, North Carolina, for an exchange semester. I arrived just as the frenzy of the upcoming election descended on my university campus. The preferred winner at my school and in the small world of Asheville was Obama, but beyond the city limits, the state of North Carolina glowed red, firmly supporting Romney. I felt like the divide between the Republican and Democratic Party was a line that could never be crossed. I'd grown up with it. My own family were Democrats. Like a moth to a political flame, I wanted to get closer to the chaos, to understand what America actually was, beyond the rhetoric of both parties. I felt I'd find answers in Washington, the country's capital. I decided to put aside my last weekend in the country for a trip there, and on my only full day, I experienced the strangest case of serendipity I'd ever encountered. I'd arranged to meet a girl called Angelica, friend of a friend. Finding out about her made this trip feel like it was meant to be. She'd just changed from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. What kind of person does that? The parties are so fundamentally different, ideologically. I wonder what kind of wisdom or contradiction she'd have to offer. Angelica had been a staunch Republican from the age of only 14, officially joining the party when she registered to vote at age 18. She'd been the secretary for her college Republican club and the Massachusetts Alliance College Republicans, and had worked on lots of campaigns, including Mitt Romney's at the beginning of 2012. She became a Republican because she believed that the government shouldn't have control over the lives of individuals. And one day, just this year, right in the middle of a Republican function, she'd had an epiphany.
So I was at CPAC, which is the Conservative Political Action Conference, in February. Someone was talking, I think it was Mike Huckabee, and I was just like, I did not like the first 15 minutes of Mike Huckabee's speech. You know, him saying that we're never going to move forward as a country until we stop abortion is really dumb. I think Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. I think we should accept that as law, because it is, and go from there. And, you know, everyone was like, that, you know, you're not a Republican. You sound like a liberal, Angelica, if you say that. Angelica, you don't understand politics. And they just were like, no, you're wrong. You don't understand. You shouldn't be a Republican if you think that. And I'm like, you guys are 20. I don't understand why you are being so silly in your thinking. I know silly is not the right word, but why are you guys thinking forward, you know? And they're like, because, you know, we're conservatives. We don't want change. I'm like, that's not the definition of a conservative. But that's when I was like, if these 20-year-olds can't agree with me and they're being, you know, they're not debating me and what they think the answer should be, and they're just telling me I'm wrong and that I'm not a Republican, maybe this isn't like the right place for me.
About halfway through the interview, she made a comment that I didn't take much notice of at first. We had started talking about the Tea Party, the ultra-conservative grassroots movement that began around 2009.
I don't know, this is why I think populist movements aren't good, because they came in and they got all these Republicans elected. And some of these Republicans weren't, if you think about the Republican Party as a whole, the Tea Party wasn't good for the Republican Party in the sense that they were really popular and then they fell out of favor really fast. It's the same with Occupy Wall Street. Like, it is really good that Occupy Wall Street didn't get a whole bunch of people elected, because people, like, first of all, like, what happened to Occupy Wall Street? Like, it's dead now.
Occupy Wall Street, was that dead now? I knew that back home in Sydney, the only remaining relic of the movement was the small presence left on the corner of Martin Place and Elizabeth Street. Beyond that, I'd heard nothing else about it. Had it really disappeared completely? I walked Angelica to the subway station and said goodbye. The difference between parties was blurred now, certainly. In everyday life, the division seemed more of a guide than a rule, with the real differences lying between individuals and their own ideas of each party. I hadn't made solid plans for the rest of the day. I didn't want to waste what little time I had left in the Capitol, so I got off at the station closest to the White House. On my way towards the Great White Monolith, I came across the Department of Veteran Affairs. In front of the building, cardboard signs had been arranged along the sidewalk, next to people in sleeping bags. It had started to rain. I looked back down at the cardboard signs, just for a moment, and when I looked up again, a man was standing right next to me. "Do you like the signs?" he asked. I nodded. Then he introduced himself.
My name is Gregory Gifford. I was born in Lowell, Mass. This is the headquarters for the Department of Veteran Affairs in Washington, D.C., and a group called Vets for Peace decided to march over here 2 months ago and demand a meeting with the leaders here or Congress to try to get benefits for veterans, because there's a lot of veterans coming back that suffer from PTSD and they have brain injuries. And so a lot of more vets are dying by their own hand than that are dying in combat in the war in Afghanistan right now.
I had found Occupy Wall Street.
There are corporations in here all day long, trying to buy you and sell you. You can't keep selling us out and stealing from us and committing crimes against our economy and not, you know, being held accountable for it. These guys, they got a license to steal because they're, you know, they own Congress. And it just goes to show you, You know, what these rich people do, they sit up in their castles and tell everybody we're the problem. We're not the problem. We're the one trying to work and make a living. It's not 47% of the people, like Romney said, that want to suck off the government teat. It doesn't work that way. Most people want to work. That's why they come to this country. You know, you can have the car or two cars in the driveway. You know, you can go out for a Sunday drive. You can go out to the drive-in theaters. You can go to the movies. You can do whatever because you're American. That's not happening anymore. You know, they're trying to take our American dream away from us. Your American dream is now a nightmare. Or you'd have to be asleep to think it's true.
The movement wasn't dead, not even close. It was alive and kicking, still passionate, still furious, and still looking to be heard by the American people. They weren't just protesting either. They were trying to rebuild communities affected by Hurricane Sandy.
The people that have lived there for generations, their homes are destroyed, they're full of mold, there's no heat, there's no electricity. People from Occupy Wall Street who are out there doing all the work, they're in there up to their elbows in mud and dirt and mold and cleaning and feeding and providing and caring about people. That's what America does. And these are true Americans from Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Sandy.
The light was fading as we finished talking, and I asked Greg to read his favorite sign out of all the ones around us. He chose a poem called The Fat Cats, written by an army vet called Barry Knight.
We are the fat cats looking down from ivory towers, protected by those who hold seats of power, changing the laws to suit all our needs, blind to the millions of hungry mouths to feed, taking all we can from those who have least, our apathetic sheep saying it's just the nature of the beast, while watching the world on wide television screens, believing Fox lies about American dreams. Just keep working hard like good little drones and don't get upset when we start taking your homes. For we are the almighty 1% gods and we'll keep you in line with our pigs and their dogs. We amass great piles of incredible wealth as we tell all our victims to tighten their belts. When they've nothing left to give and nowhere to go, we say, look, there's the problem way down below. It's those poor lazy fools living in the street, sucking off America's diminishing teat. They sponge off entitlements we all provide. It's their fault, taxpayers, they have a free ride. We support these poor saps with food stamps and welfare. They are the ones who don't like to share. And we sell all these lies to those still surviving, so they keep electing our puppets and keep us cats thriving.
I left Washington early the next morning. I'd been shaken out of my American dream. There are certain American realities that are hard to shake. The ridiculously low rate of minimum wage and salary in general, the healthcare system, gun violence. I'd escaped all of that. My mum had received the healthcare she'd needed until she passed away. I'd never had to worry about paying rent on $7.25 an hour. I wasn't American. I hadn't lived this kind of America. Deep down, I'd known these darker realities had existed, but now there was no denying them by remembering the sun-filled memories of my childhood. Now there's only two things I can be certain of, that there's no one American story, and that I return to the US. And when I do, I'll keep a lookout for more American dreams. For messages in streets, for poets speaking truths, and for the people refusing to color themselves just red or only blue.
Madeline Cummings. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Belinda Lopez, and today we're telling stories about America. And in our studio right now, we've got a real-life American with us. Hi, Serafina.
Hello.
No, Serafina, you deserve a much better introduction than that. Serafina is the creator of This Place Is Yours. It's a storytelling, I guess you could call it a storytelling movement that started up in Australia. Serafina, we're going to hear more about This Place Is Yours a bit later on, but I know for our listeners, if you're a regular listener to All the Best, there's a good chance that you've been interested in American storytelling culture as well, especially in radio storytelling culture. As Aussie as All the Best is in its focus, we couldn't deny the influence of American radio shows like This American Life in the style that we've come to tell stories on the radio. And I guess from an Australian perspective, Americans have a much more open, confessional style of speaking about their lives. Everything that ranges from the lowest of the lowbrow, Jerry Springer, up to This American Life. Serafina, you grew up in Los Angeles, right?
I did.
Would you say that that kind of confessional storytelling or openness was a big part of growing up?
Funnily enough, it wasn't, not for me. I grew up in a family where silence was golden, so we wouldn't talk about anything. And I think that is the culture of abuse, is that nobody says a thing. I remember actually watching things like Oprah. Oprah was my first hero. And then Ira Glass quickly followed.
From This American Life.
Oh, yes. I'm absolutely obsessed with him. But I would watch Oprah, and I just really connected to the content, I guess, because nothing in my household was spoken of. I got depression pretty early on. And I guess, when I started to see these conversations that were being had over television, especially on Oprah, it really, I guess, showed me what was possible in this world, that we could actually speak about things that burdened us. So I guess, yeah, on the one hand, the open culture of America really inspired me to tell my stories. But unfortunately, that wasn't what I lived with. And I will say, though, my parents weren't American. They were immigrants. My mother was from Africa, and my father was from India. So I think that those cultures are pretty silent. And like I said, I think that was a lot to do with abuse as well, that nothing was spoken about. I think that when pain has nowhere to go, when you just stuff it inside, I guess, you know, it has to be released somehow. So you're either releasing it through your self-expression, which is my whole thing now, which is, kind of getting all that out through creativity, or you're releasing it through your attitude and your anger and the way that you treat others, and most importantly, the way that you treat yourself.
When, for you, when was the turning point? You said, you know, you'd obviously had a very difficult childhood, but when was the turning point when you said, that's it, I'm going to share my story and I'm going to be open and I'm not going to perpetrate the culture of my family?
Yeah, so I got really depressed. I was really sad when I was growing up. When I left home, I moved to Australia. I kind of like went as far away as I could. And I actually got really depressed again at 25. And this was unlike anything else I'd experienced before. I think when you grow up, your ability, you can't handle depression anymore. Like, your responsibilities are so extreme. And, you know, you've got a life that you have to live. And I was always one of those people, I used to get really close to people and not have many other people. So I was really close to this one girl, and from pretty much the second I got depressed, just like our relationship just kind of exploded. She said this thing where it's like you were like the boy who cried wolf. You were sad for so long that it felt like it wasn't even real. At that point I saw, wow, like nobody gets what it's like to have something that you actually need to talk about with people around you. We need each other to survive. And so I think that was probably the turning point, was that friendship evaporating. And the way that I did recover, since I didn't have her to talk about, was that I started writing about it. I had a blog going for a while where I wrote, but I hadn't touched on depression yet. And it's funny, like I was always really pro speaking about it, even in my early 20s. But when I got it, it was such a different experience. Like, the shame of having it and telling people was so strong. I just really didn't want to have it to begin with, but I definitely didn't want anyone to necessarily know about it. So when I broke that down and I just decided I'm just going to be vulnerable, and I wrote about it, I got all of these emails that just came flooding into me saying, you know, thank you for telling your story. Mine is so similar. I wish more people would speak out. I wish more people would let me know that I'm not alone. And that was the biggest thing when I was going through it as well, was just this feeling of isolation. So, and then also I started consuming a lot of stories about people that had faced similar challenges. I read this book called Your Voice in My Head by Emma Forrest and Stephen Fry's The Life of a Manic Depressive. I guess I just saw that other people were kind of standing up and doing this, and why couldn't I felt like my calling was kind of given to me in that set of really messed up but also beautiful things that happened.
And that was in Australia that it happened?
Yeah, I mean, but Emma Forrest is British and Stephen Fry is British.
So nothing to do with the Aussies. And I wanted to ask you, actually, like, you know, it happened in Australia, but it's interesting because Australians, as I said, often find Americans quite confessional. I want to ask, at a time when you needed kind of interaction and openness more than ever, what was it like to be in Australian society?
Oh, gosh. Australia doesn't want to talk about pretty much anything. Like, it seems like things here are, it is such a, I love this country so much. It is so beautiful and the people are so beautiful. But there is this sort of resistance in, I guess, talking about feelings, which is, I think, like a dirty word here. And I've definitely, it's been really challenging, I guess, to face something like depression here. And I think that a cultural shift like this, I think it's a massive one that needs to take place, because it's not, you know, people are dying because of the silence. I feel like at this stage, the best way that we're going to start sharing those issues is through our creativity and sharing that with each other.
Is that what you're trying to do with This Place Is Yours? It's probably a good time to tell us more about it. Is this what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. So we've got a website where everyone is encouraged to share their stories on any media really that they choose, whether that's art or photography or writing or poetry. And everyone else can see that they're not alone as well. And you realize what a kind of a community is out there. And that experience in itself is quite amazing.
There are infinite places for people to tell their story now, on the web especially. What makes This Place Is Yours special or different?
I guess I think our focus on that deep and meaningful conversation is probably, it's just so inclusive and you really can tell any story and it's kind of boundaryless, which is nice.
And if any of our listeners are in Sydney, This Place Is Yours is actually appearing at the Vivid Festival.
Yeah, so we're having a launch. Six speakers, including this lovely host, is going to be sharing stories about storytelling. So it's they're all sharing personal narratives about their own explorations with the art of story. We've got a photographer, a children's book author, a radio producer, a spoken word poet, a documentary maker, and then a mental health advocate. So it's quite a varied mix, and it's a celebration of the art of story.
And that's at the Museum of Contemporary Art on May 26th. What time?
From 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And you can book your tickets online just on the vividsydney.com website.
Serafina, thank you for sharing your story.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this week. All the Best is produced at FBI Radio Sydney in association with Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ in Brisbane and SYN in Melbourne. Our show is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm the features executive producer of the show. Our production manager is Carly Ann Keneally and our executive producer is Jordana Caputo. See you next week.